This is a Battle of Britain podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum. The Victoria Cross was instituted in 1856 as Britain's highest award for valour in the presence of the enemy, without regard for rank. The medal was designed to be plain and cast from a cheap metal, in this case from bronze cannon captured in the Crimea, so that the medal itself had no intrinsic value. There was also to be no special rank or privileges associated with it, except for a small pension, and as such the medal, in its simplicity and coarseness, was to inversely reflect the outstanding devotion to duty and bravery required to win the medal, a reflection of its truly democratic nature. This prestigious medal was awarded on three occasions during the official dates of the Battle of Britain, 10th of July to the 31st of October 1940, but a case can be made that a fourth Victoria Cross was won during the battle, though it falls just outside of the official dates. This is the story of the four men who are recognised with their nation's highest honour for bravery. The Luftwaffe attacks of early July were directed mainly against the Channel ports and shipping, and it was on the 4th of July that the first Battle of Britain VC was won. The day dawned bright and clear, with the last remnants of early morning mist burning off round the coast. In Portland Harbour were a number of merchant vessels lying at anchor, as well as HMS Foyle Bank. The Foyle Bank, anchored at the entrance to the harbour, was a converted merchant ship built in Belfast in 1930 for the Bank Line. She had been requisitioned by the Admiralty and returned to Belfast for conversion to an auxiliary anti-aircraft ship. The ship's newly fitted armament consisted of four twin high-angle 4-inch turrets, 2 fore and 2 aft, 2 4-barrelled 2-pounder pom-pom guns positioned port and starboard, with an additional 4.5-inch Vickers machine guns. She was commissioned on the 30th of May 1940 and had arrived in Portland Harbour on the 9th of June for working up, with a complement of 298 officers and men. The normal routine was being observed on the ship, with half of the armament being manned while the remainder of the crew went below for breakfast. At 08:25, the duty watch reported unidentified aircraft approximately 40 miles to the southeast and raised a yellow flag to inform the rest of the ships in the harbour and the harbour authorities. Although no fighter aircraft were scrambled, the RAF confirmed 6+ enemy aircraft and action stations was called. As the crew rushed to their stations, the first of 33 Stuka dive bombers peeled off from a height of about 5,000 feet to attack the harbour. A merchant tanker in Weymouth Bay was the first ship to be hit. The ship was set on fire and would burn for the next 24 hours. The Foyle Bank then became the prime target for the Stukas. During the next 8 minutes, the ship was bombed and strafed with machine gun fire. A and B turrets were put out of action almost immediately, as were the ship's electrics. Early in the action, a bomb exploded very close to the starboard pom-pom gun, on which leading seaman Jack Mantle was a crew member. Many of the gun crew were killed or injured. Mantle's left leg was shattered by the blast, which had bent the changeover lever that controlled the powering of the gun. Mantle, despite his injuries, struggled to move the lever from electrics to hand firing. Having achieved this, he resumed firing the gun, but was soon wounded again in many places, and between bursts of firing had time to reflect on his grievous injuries, of which he would soon die. As the German aircraft left, Mantle slumped forward onto the gun. Small boats soon came alongside to take off the wounded and the dead. By the time they reached Mantle, he was dead. He was 23 years of age. The Foyle Bank was hit by no fewer than 22 bombs and was continually strafed during the attack, with consequent heavy loss of life. The ship sank later that day. Further attacks against shipping in the Channel were conducted later in the day, which forced the Navy to abandon the Channel as a route for convoys. Leading seaman Jack Mantle was born in Wandsworth in 1917 and had joined the Navy aged 16. He was posthumously mentioned in dispatches on the 9th of July 1940 for apparently shooting down an enemy aircraft while on convoy escort duty with a Lewis gun earlier in the year. Mantle was buried in the Naval Cemetery overlooking Portland Harbour, where he had so valiantly lost his life. His Victoria Cross was gazetted on the 4th of September 1940, and it remains the only VC to be won in home waters. While it can be rightly considered that Fighter Command won the Battle of Britain, it must not be forgotten that the other RAF commands played a significant supporting role. Indeed, the first Victoria Cross to be won by the Royal Air Force in the Battle of Britain was awarded to a pilot of Bomber Command, Flight Lieutenant Learoyd. Roderick Alastair Brooke Learoyd was born in Folkestone on February 5, 1913, and was educated at Wellington College in Berkshire. He then studied at the Chelsea College of Aeronautical Engineering. After leaving education, Learoyd drifted around trying his hand at various roles. For a time, he was a fruit farmer in Argentina, before returning to the UK and working in the motor trade. He applied for, and was given, a short service commission into the RAF in 1936. A quiet, slightly reserved man, he was, by those who knew him, a friendly person and a good man to have at a party. Nicknamed Babe because of his large stature, he was serving with 49 Squadron at the outbreak of war. This was the first squadron to receive the new Hanley Page Hampden, the aircraft in which Learoyd was flying when he won his VC. The attack on the Dortmund Ems Canal Aqueduct, in which Learoyd would win his Victoria Cross, was strategic in that the canal was a vital inland waterway communication system, but also tactical because barges were being sent up the canal toward the coast in preparation for the invasion. The Germans were fully aware of the importance of the canal and its vulnerability where it crossed the River Ems via two aqueducts. Bomber Command had already conducted several raids on this target, the most recent being on the night of the 25th of July. Reconnaissance on the 29th had shown that one of the aqueducts had been damaged, creating a bottleneck for canal traffic. In response, the Germans had strengthened the air defences around the aqueducts, bringing in a large number of mobile anti-aircraft guns, as well as a battery of searchlights, designed not only to pick out the aircraft for anti-aircraft guns to fire on, but also to dazzle and blind any attacking aircraft. Another raid was planned to further restrict traffic on the canal. This time it was decided to conduct a low-level attack using a new type of canister bomb with a 10-minute delayed fuse. Crews were briefed early in the day to give the navigators time to plot their course. It was also stressed that the arrival on time at the target and the timing of the bomb run were crucial because of the delayed action fuses being used. 11 aircraft were scheduled for the operation, with 5 actually to bomb the target while the others performed diversionary raids. The 11 Hampden bombers, 6 from 49 Squadron and 5 from 83 Squadron, took off from RAF Scampton at 2000 hours on the 12th of August 1940. The night was clear and bright with a half moon. The aircraft were to approach the target from the north. This would give the advantage of the moon lighting the target from behind and assist the bomb aimer in dropping his bombs as accurately as possible. Approaching from the darkest part of the sky would also hinder the anti-aircraft gunners being able to pick out their targets too easily. Shortly after 2300, the aircraft arrived over the target, and the first Hampden, that of Squadron Leader Pitcairn Hill of 83 Squadron, began its attack. The aircraft flew down to 150 feet for its run-in down the valley toward the target. Through a hail of flak and blinding lights, despite suffering much damage, with both gunners suffering injury to their head and hands and their wireless being destroyed, managed to drop its bombs accurately before turning away and heading for home. The second Hampden, flown by an Australian, Pilot Officer Ross, received a direct hit just as it was entering its bomb run and crashed in flames at the side of the canal. Another Australian, Flying Officer Mulligan, piloting the third Hampden, then entered its bomb run, levelling out at 150 feet. Just as it reached its bomb release point, it was hit and one of its engines burst into flames. Quickly, jettisoning his bombs, the aircraft climbed steeply, where Mulligan prepared to crash land the aircraft. On landing, the aircraft broke up, killing two of the crew. Flight Lieutenant Mulligan and the other survivor, Sergeant Younger, were taken prisoner. For his action during the raid, Flight Lieutenant Mulligan was awarded the DFC. Fourth in was Pilot Officer Matthews, who completed a successful bomb run despite losing one of his engines. The aircraft and its crew returned to England safely on the one engine. It was now Learoyd's time to attack. The last aircraft in, this was the most dangerous of all the attacks because the element of surprise had been lost. The anti-aircraft gunners now had their eye in on the low-flying targets. 6 minutes since the start of the attack, Learoyd headed into the valley. Levelling out at 150 feet, he let his bomb aimer, Pilot Officer Lewis, know that he was now in control of the run-in. As with the other aircraft, they ran the gauntlet of anti-aircraft fire. To avoid being hit, Learoyd ducked below the cockpit's windscreen, flying the aircraft on instruments and the feedback from Pilot Officer Lewis. 2 shells passed through the aircraft's wing, while many machine gun bullets riddled the aircraft. When the aircraft had dropped its bombs, Lewis called, OK, finish. The aircraft climbed and banked away from the target and set a course for home. After the attack, the damage inflicted on the aircraft could be assessed. The shells through the wings had luckily missed the fuel tanks. However, the hydraulics were ruptured, which meant that the aircraft's flaps were drooping and there were no undercarriage indicators. To relieve the tension, the radio operator, Sergeant Ellis, announced to the crew that one of his carrier pigeons had laid an egg in the midst of the attack. The aircraft limped home, and as they arrived over Scampton, Leroy decided not to attempt to land in the darkness, uncertain as to the extent of the damage to his aircraft. He circled for nearly 3 hours until first light, and landed successfully at about 0500. The raid on the Dortmund-Ems Canal caused considerable damage to the aqueduct, closing it to traffic for some time afterwards. This delay in the movement of barges to the coast severely impacted on the planned invasion build-up. Squadron leader Pitcairn Hill was awarded the DSO for his part in the attack. He was sadly killed a month later in a raid on invasion barges at Antwerp. For his role in the attack, Flight Lieutenant Leroy was awarded the Victoria Cross, which was gazetted on the 20th of August, just 8 days after the raid took place. Leroy was taken off operations shortly after this, but returned to operations in 1941 with 83 Squadron, and then 44 Squadron, before retiring from operations in 1943. He survived the war and became an export sales manager for Austin Motors. He died, aged 83, in 1996. The third Victoria Cross, awarded during the Battle of Britain, was not only Fighter Command's only Victoria Cross of the battle, but the only Victoria Cross awarded to a pilot of Fighter Command during the war. Eric James Brindley Nicholson was born in Hampstead on the 29th of April 1917, the eldest child of four. After school, he was employed as an experimental engineer by a company in Shoreham-by-Sea. Deciding on a career in the RAF, he began training as a pilot at the de Havilland School of Flying in October 1936, before enlisting with the RAF in the December of that year. On completion of his RAF training, he was posted to 72 Squadron at Church Fenton. He settled down to squadron life and proved himself popular with the other pilots. He quickly became known simply as Nick. He enjoyed a party, was a good storyteller with quite an extrovert nature, and a self-confessed expert on everything. While stationed at Church Fenton, he met his future wife, Muriel Kendall, the daughter of a farmer who lived in the nearby village of Kirkby Wharf. They became engaged in January 1938 and married in July of the following year. Nicholson was assessed by his commanding officer as an above-average pilot, and he often took part in flying displays performing aerobatics. On the outbreak of war, 72 Squadron remained in the north of England and was largely engaged in intercepting reconnaissance aircraft. In May 1940, Nicholson was posted to the newly reformed 249 Squadron as a flight commander and was promoted to the rank of acting flight lieutenant in early June. 249 had originally been equipped with Spitfires, but due to the needs of fighter command, these aircraft were taken and sent south, and 249 was re-equipped with Hurricanes. The squadron soon found themselves pitched into the heart of the battle, receiving orders to move to Boscombe Down in Wiltshire on the 14th of August. The 16th of August promised to be a beautiful summer's day. The Luftwaffe delayed their raids until mists in the Channel had burned off, with the first reported raids picked up at about 10:45 in the morning. Targets for raids on the 16th, again, tended to concentrate on ports, airfields, shipping and radar stations. 249 Squadron was scrambled shortly after 12 o'clock and was sent to patrol an area between Poole and Ringwood. Nicholson soon spotted enemy aircraft in the vicinity of Gosport and informed the leader of A Flight, who detailed Red Section to intercept. Red Section, led by Nicholson, with Pilot Officer King as Red 2 and Squadron Leader King as Red 3, then peeled away to attack the three enemy aircraft below them. This was to be the first taste of aerial combat for all three pilots. As they made their approach, they watched as 12 Spitfires attacked the enemy aircraft. Realising that there was no point continuing, Nicholson ordered his section to rejoin the squadron. As they turned and started climbing back to the squadron, the section were caught completely by surprise by German fighters coming out of the sun. All three aircraft were immediately hit. Squadron Leader King, the least badly hit, dived away and managed to fly his damaged aircraft back to Boscombe Down, where he performed a forced landing. Pilot Officer King quickly abandoned his aircraft, which was now on fire. His parachute was seen to deploy, but at about 1,500 feet, the canopy collapsed, and Pilot Officer King fell to his death in the back garden of a house in Shirley in Southampton. Pilot Officer King was aged 19. Nicholson's Hurricane had been hit by 4 cannon shells, one hitting the reserve fuel tank, which immediately caught fire, another hitting his left foot, the third hit the canopy, which sent perspex splinters into his eye. One splinter almost severed his eyelid. The other struck the side of the cockpit and shredded his trousers. As soon as he heard the cannon strike, Nicholson dived hard to his left. With his aircraft on fire and himself badly wounded, he prepared to abandon his aircraft. But just as he was about to do so, he noticed a Messerschmitt 110 diving at a similar angle and on a converging course. Noting that his reflector sight was still on, Nicholson slipped back into his seat and opened fire on the Messerschmitt at 200 yards. The enemy aircraft flew an avoiding course, zigzagging as Nicholson continued to fire. As both aircraft were still diving, the flames inside Nicholson's Hurricane were being blown onto him as if by a blowtorch. As he followed the enemy down, he noticed the skin on his left hand peeling back in the flames. Although he says at the time he was not aware of the pain, he was aware of the heat, and after one last burst, he eventually decided to jump. But jumping out of his seat, he banged his head on the canopy, having forgotten to open it. Finally, unbuckling himself, he leaped from the aircraft, and tumbling down, he pulled his ripcord at 5,000 feet. Evaluating what had happened, he was glad to note that he had left his oxygen mask on, as it had saved his face. He realized there were no broken bones, but his thighs, hands, eyes and calves were badly burnt, and Nicholson soon began to feel the pain all over his body. Having assessed his injuries, Nicholson took stock of his position and realized that he was heading out to sea, and that with the injuries he had sustained, if he were to land in the water, he would be unlikely to survive. He managed to guide his parachute round to head inland. Avoiding a high-tension cable, he was then shot at by an enthusiastic member of the local defence volunteers, receiving shotgun pellets in his buttocks. There had been a number of observers on the ground who rushed to the badly burned pilot. One of them was PC Eric Coleman. He was very keen to get the burnt pilot to the hospital as soon as possible, but Nicholson insisted that the policeman take a dictation of telegrams that he was to send to his wife and station commander. In his telegram to Muriel, he said, "Shot down. Very slightly hurt. Full particulars later. All my love, Nick." In his logbook for the day, he simply wrote, "Shot down. Bailed out." Taken to Southampton Hospital, Nicholson was thought to have only 24 hours to live. However, he responded well to his treatment and was then moved to a burns unit at RAF Alton. While he was convalescing at the Palace Hotel, Bournemouth, he received a telegram. Thinking it was a court-martial, he was shocked to see that he had been awarded the Victoria Cross. He was at the time sat with an old friend from 72 Squadron, and his first words after reading the telegram were, "Now I'll have to earn it." A little while after, he sent a telegram to his wife. "Darling, just got VC. Don't know why. Letter follows. All my love. Nick." Slightly embarrassed about the award, Nicholson refused to wear the medal ribbon until he was reprimanded for being improperly dressed. He was keen to be operational again, but instead he was posted to ground instructional duties in February 1941. After a series of largely administrative roles, he was finally granted his wish and was posted to command 27 Squadron, operating bow fighters in East Bengal in August 1943. The squadron re-equipped with Mosquitoes in December of that year, and Nicholson remained with them until August 1944. There followed a number of desk jobs, and in May 1945, while on the staff of Royal Air Force Burma headquarters, he was granted permission to fly on an operation as an observer in a Liberator from 355 Squadron on a bombing mission. The aircraft took off from Salbani in India and set course for Rangoon. At 10 to 1 in the morning of the 2nd of May 1945, about 2.5 hours into the flight, the starboard outer engine caught fire. Shortly after that, the starboard inner engine caught fire. The crew tried to extinguish the fire, but realizing they were unable to do so, the pilot ordered the crew to prepare for ditching. Within 15 seconds of hitting the water, the aircraft sank. Four crew members escaped from the aircraft. One of the two survivors picked up the following day after clinging to the nose wheel of the Liberator in shark-infested waters, thought that Nicholson might have been one of the four in the water. His body was never recovered, and Wing Commander Nicholson's name is remembered on the Singapore Memorial. He was 29 years of age. The last of the Battle of Britain Victoria Crosses was awarded to the youngest airman recipient of a Victoria Cross. Sergeant John Hanna was aged only 18 at the time of his actions on the night of the 15th-16th September 1940, having only been in the RAF for just over a year. Born in 1921 in Paisley, after he completed his schooling, he spent time as a shoe salesman before signing up for a six-year enlistment on the 15th of August 1939. On finishing his basic training, he was then trained as a wireless operator and was mustered as a wireless operator air gunner in May 1940. Posted initially to 106 Squadron, Hanna then joined 83 Squadron, operating Hanley Page Hamdens at RAF Skempton in early August 1940. Numerous raids had already been carried out up and down the coast of Belgium and northern France against the shipping and port installations in what has subsequently been called the Battle of the Barges, in an effort to disrupt the invasion preparations. The build-up of the invasion fleets in these ports had seen the Germans strengthen anti-aircraft defences around these facilities, with many light anti-aircraft guns, searchlights and balloon barrages being installed. On the night of the 15th to 16th of September, a number of Bomber Command squadrons were tasked with bombing enemy barge concentrations at various points along the Channel coast of France and the Low Countries. For 83 Squadron, the target was to be Antwerp. The aircraft took off from Skempton at 22:30, and set course for the Belgian coast. The flight to the target was uneventful. The night was clear with a bright full moon, which helped the crews in finding the barges assembled on the waters of the Scheldt. As the aircraft approached their target, they were met by an intense barrage of anti-aircraft fire supported by searchlight batteries. The pilot of Sergeant Hanna's aircraft, a Canadian, Pilot Officer Connor, commenced his bomb run at an altitude of 2,000 feet. As he approached the target, he realised that the aircraft was slightly offline, and rather than drop his bombs inaccurately, he pulled his aircraft out of its run and banked round to commence a second pass, all the while flying through the anti-aircraft fire. This second run was on target, and just as the bomb aimer, Sergeant Hayhurst, yelled that the bombs were gone, the aircraft received a direct hit in the bomb bay. Almost immediately, a fire broke out in the rear of the aircraft's fuselage. Fanned by the aircraft's slipstream, it quickly engulfed Sergeant Hanna and Sergeant James, the other gunner. The heat was so intense that metal around Sergeant James's seat melted away and left Sergeant James no option but to bail out. As Sergeant Hanna recalled later, he thought that the aircraft was about to explode. "I made for my parachute, only to find it was on fire too, so you can guess there was some panic." Hanna then told Pilot Officer Connor over the intercom that the aircraft was on fire. When Connor asked Hanna if it was bad, with typical British understatement, he answered, "Bad, but not too bad." Connor then asked Hayhurst to go to the rear of the aircraft to see how James and Hanna were coping. As Hayhurst crawled through the cockpit, he reached the midship's door that he found to be warped due to the heat and jammed. Unable to open the door, he peered through the door window. He could see no sign of James, and Hanna appeared to be engulfed in flames. He assumed that both men were dead or about to die. He then turned and headed forward and bailed out himself. At this time, Hanna was actually trying to push through the buckled door to access the aircraft's fire extinguishers. Despite his clothing being on fire and the aircraft's ammunition held in racks on the wall being cooked off and firing off all around him, he managed to force the door open. Successful in getting hold of a fire extinguisher, he set about tackling the fire. But the heat, not only from the fire, but also his heavy and cumbersome flying clothes, made him feel faint, and he was possibly slowly suffocating from the lack of oxygen. He turned on pure oxygen through his face mask, so that he could continue to fight the fire. Having exhausted the aircraft's two extinguishers, Sergeant Hanna resorted to beating the flames with his logbook until the fire was out. All this took around 10 minutes. With the fire now extinguished, Hanna turned his attention to the ammunition drums, which were still firing off rounds all around him. He proceeded to throw the red-hot drums out of the aircraft. His citation makes a note of the conditions in the rear of the aircraft, which Hanna had to work under, such that the aluminium sheet metal on the floor of this airman's cockpit was melted away, leaving only the crossbearers on which to stand. Hanna crawled forward to the pilot to tell him the state of the aircraft and fire. Connor was shocked at the sight of Hanna. His clothes were burnt, his hands were severely burned, his face was black where the skin had been exposed. Having received second-degree burns to his face and eyes, his eyebrows had been burned off and his eyes were swollen. Connor asked Hanna to check on the rest of the crew. Hanna returned to Connor to report to his surprise, "We're all alone." Going back to his radio set to get a fix and issue an SOS, he found that his wireless was unserviceable due to the fire. As he returned to Connor, he picked up the navigator's maps and logs, handing them to the pilot so that he could navigate the crippled aircraft back to Scampton. Touching down, just after 3 a.m, Hanna was rushed to hospital where his burns were treated. He wrote to his mother saying that, "The only snag is I cannot eat. My skin is all frizzled up." Hanna's Victoria Cross was promulgated on the 1st of October. Sergeant Hayhurst and Sergeant James became prisoners of war, Sergeant Hayhurst being awarded the DFM for his actions, whilst Pilot Officer Connor's DFC was gazetted on the 8th of October 1940. Sadly, Connor, now a flying officer, was killed in early November, returning from a raid on Kiel, in which his aircraft was hit by flak. His aircraft crashed into the sea off Spurn Head, but his body was recovered and he was buried near Scampton. Hanna did not return to operations, being posted as an instructor to RAF Cottesmore, where he met his future wife, Janet, in early 1941. Sadly, his health started to fail him, and he contracted tuberculosis, which ultimately led to his discharge from the RAF with a full pension in December 1942. On leaving the service, Hanna struggled to provide for his young family. No longer physically fit to undertake full-time employment, he resorted to doing theatrical turns, as was reported in the Sydney Sun. Boy VC goes on the stage to live. Embarrassed by this, the Ministry of Pensions determined to see if they could find suitable work for him. However, not much is known of his time after this, although he might have found some employment as a taxi driver. Flight Sergeant John Hanna died in June 1947, aged 25, leaving a wife and 3 daughters. In 1967, his widow Janet presented his Victoria Cross to 83 Squadron at Scampton. Flying helmet and goggles, which Sergeant Hanna wore on the night of the 15th-16th of September 1940, as well as his Victoria Cross, which was purchased by the Royal Air Force Museum in 1982, are on display in the museum's Bomber Command Hall. Flight Lieutenant Nicholson's Victoria Cross was purchased by the museum with aid from the National Heritage Memorial Fund in 1983, and is now on display in the Battle of Britain Hall. His flying logbooks were bequeathed by his widow Muriel to the museum in 2006.
That was a podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum's Battle of Britain series. If you would like to learn more about the history of the Battle of Britain, why not visit the museum's Battle of Britain Hall in London, which houses the world's most comprehensive collection of aircraft that fought in the battle. The hall is open daily from 12 noon to 6 p.m.